This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge their continued connection to land, waters, and culture. Genocide and colonization are ongoing processes that continue to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello and welcome to AusPol Snack Pod, the podcast where we usually bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news and crispy memes, and the official podcast of the AusPol Shitposting Facebook group. But we're not going to be bringing you politics and news this week. We're going to be doing an interview. My name's Noon. I'm the admin and creator of AusPol Shitposting, and with me is my co-host.
Hey, Zach the Snack, and I am drinking a beer. So if you hear sipping, I'm sorry.
So last week we had an interview where Zach interviewed me about my life in politics and so on. And so this week I'm going to be talking to Zach. We've pre-recorded these episodes so that we can have a little bit of time off over the festive season, but so that all of you can still get some snack pod in your ears.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you are really just come here for the news and stuff, feel free to skip this one.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're new to the podcast, that you definitely should
probably
start
not
here.
An ideal starting place. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So go listen to our back catalog, not too far back because we had shitty mics at the start. But once you like the show, come back and hear all about Zach and what he's into.
We should really take down those early episodes.
Yeah,
I'll get around to it at some point. It's like like when on a podcast they say, "Oh, we'll cut that out later," and you just know they're not gonna. But we can delete those other episodes. You know they're not gonna do that either.
I mean, we should, though. It's really irritating every time I like look at our listens for the week and episode one has got listens. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh,
that's terrible.
No.
Yeah, going back and listening to it. And it's not just poorly recorded, but it's also full of like factual errors as well.
Which the new ones, slightly
still,
less.
Yeah, a little less so, hopefully.
Yeah.
Ideally. Let me just... You're off mic a little bit. There we go.
Yo, I'm back in it.
Yeah.
So, Zach... I guess I wanted to ask you, about your politics and what's motivating you and your life. So, do you have any, like, political identity that you subscribe to or any, like, major values that you feel are, like, core to your life and actions?
I knew I should have studied for this.
Yeah.
I knew this question was going to come up and I don't have an answer for it, really.
You just got to be yourself, right? That's
I guess... maybe turn Zach into and philosophy into some kind of pun. No, look, I guess probably I am some form of communist, maybe. Or no, like I'm not that sure. I definitely know that I've absorbed a fair amount of like Marxist theory sort of by osmosis by just hanging out in leftist spaces online and IRL as well. But I've never done any serious reading of like hard economic philosophy or never read any like Marx or whomever.
I mean, the answer I was expecting you to give was feminism and veganism.
Those are probably the two most important like philosophical principles, I guess, or if you want to call them that, or political affiliations that I have. Definitely like my entry into everything else political, my entry point was definitely feminism. Mm. Hashtag male feminist.
Yeah. So do you maybe want to
as much as I can like self-apply that label. Yes. Well, Noon, I'm really glad you asked that question. I mean, similarly to what you were talking about last week, with the way that your parents and your upbringing kind of influenced, your development, my mom was and is a serious card-carrying feminist, the type of feminist that got arrested for doing feminist actions and that kind of thing.
Sick.
Shout out mums. Good job, mums. I definitely grew up around that. She's like an art academic, fine art academic. So, I was exposed to a lot of like feminist art and even feminist theory, like from a relatively young age.
I remember having dinner at your place one time when we were in high school, and there was like a bunch of art of naked women, and you were like,
most of those are probably my mom, yeah.
Right. I remember you like giving me like an impromptu lecture about like the way that the male gaze is like reenacted in art galleries or something.
That
was just kind of like an offhand remark about the art on your wall. So.
Yeah, totally. The idea of the male gaze is something I very specifically remember my mum introducing me to when she was driving me to school one day, and there was an ad for, I'm sure it was like stockings or something, and it had a very sort of overtly sexualized image of a woman on it, and my mum was like, oh, that's disgusting. And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, yeah, well, women aren't objects, and so let's start there. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely... like more than any kind of affiliation to like a party or a political philosophy is definitely kind of was my entry point, and that's how I probably developed, I guess, politically speaking. And I've definitely got through like a lot of changes in that way. Like, I think I have this kind of theory, I guess, about the way that political development happens in individuals, and specifically as it refers specifically to the development of men who identify as feminist, or kind of learning to understand their own privilege, or the way that other people's experiences don't mirror their own perfectly. And they've got like a lot of learning to do, and I actually may be inadvertently doing a whole bunch of harm in the world. But it's this kind of idea of like, you learn early, you're like, one of the first things you might learn is like, okay, don't use language that is derogatory for women. That was definitely something that my parents taught me early on. And then so you kind of think to yourself as a young budding boy, like, yeah, I don't use XYZ word. I'm a feminist. I'm doing a good job. And then you kind of live a little bit more life and you realize that there's a lot more to it than that. And I guess, you know, it's a relatively common thing, I think, that you see in like, and definitely in like white people who are trying to undo their own internalized like white supremacy, is that they'll kind of learn something, realize they're doing something wrong, take action to correct it, and then be like, okay, cool. I've done it. I've done the development. And then something else would kind of come along, and often there's kind of a bit of a defensive reaction to that. Like, no, like, what do you mean? I can't have done this sexist thing. I know about feminism. I call myself a feminist. I talk about feminism with my friends. I can't have done this feminist, this sexist thing, rather, this misogynist thing. But of course, you don't get to ever stop developing. You're never all the way there. And I guess it's taken a long time for me personally to learn to try to reject that instinct of defensiveness when it comes up. When you get called out for that kind of thing, it's hard to kind of take yourself out of it a little bit and not take it personally, and just kind of understand like, this is probably someone trying to help you. If they're actually telling you you're doing something wrong, they probably actually care about your development, right?
You said before that you haven't read any like dense political theory or something, but something I really admire about you is that you're constantly reading feminist political theory and other stuff that challenges your worldview and that informs it, and that you're always going out of your way to pick that stuff up and to take it seriously and try to integrate it. And maybe we can come back to this a bit after we've talked about veganism, but you've talked to me a lot about that book Afroism, which I think has been important for you recently, and I've learned a lot from you about intersectional feminism and intersectional veganism and the way that they cross over with race. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I think that you do go out of your way to learn that stuff and to develop politically and as a feminist.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably true. I'm definitely really interested in that. I guess I was talking more specifically, like, I don't know what kind of new political order I would put in place of the current one after we burn it down. I know that I want to burn it down, very supportive of the burning. Then afterwards, do I want anarchy or do I want communism?
Step three, question mark. Step four, profit.
Yeah, exactly. abolish profit.
Step four,
abolish. So, profit. No, I mean, I guess, and I do honestly think like it's a big gap in my, I don't know, like political outlook. And I, In the sense that, like, I don't really have an idea of what I would like the running of, say, Australia to look like. Beyond that, I think that capitalism is bad and that representative parliamentary democracy has absolutely failed us. Well, it's failed us. It hasn't. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do, which is protect private property, whatever. I mean, that's very Marxist.
It is, yeah, some good shit, my
dude. Yeah, never read a word of it in my life. I was having a conversation with a friend a few months ago, and she was kind of asking me, like, what are you politically? Because I was, talking about how I really don't feel like I have any faith in the current political order in Australia, like, at all. And she was just kind of, she was asking me, so what do you want to do instead? We've got like max 10 years to effectively address climate change. What other system would you rather have in place? And I honestly don't have an answer for that question. That's something I'm still kind of searching for. I guess there's a little bit of, sometimes I feel a little bit of, I don't know, a bit of like a tension or like self-consciousness or whatever about being a co-host of a political podcast and still feeling like I am in many ways still kind of learning and kind of underdeveloped. And I mean, I honestly only really started taking a super specific interest in Australian politics relatively recently, say over the last like 2-3 years. So I'm not steeped in it in the same way that you have been. Like, we talked about your political development before, and you were doing, you know, activist stuff and having to confront, you know, philosophical questions about your own existence, like, much earlier than I did. I think I'm still sort of finding my feet in that way. And maybe I just need to read a little bit of Marx. Maybe that'll help me out.
You just sort of said that your interest in Australian politics is sort of relatively recent. Was there like a particular event in the political sort of situation that led to that, or like a particular person that made you interested, or like, yeah, how did you kind of decide to get more into that?
I'm not sure that I can put my finger on it precisely. I think it's really accelerated in the last 2 years in particular, because I've taken a job in the not-for-profit sector, and there was something about being that organization deals in politics a lot. I was kind of having to engage with it as part of my job and get a little bit more familiar with the political process. So that's probably got something to do with it. But also being on the inside of that, of the kind of like NGO sector, and seeing what other people were doing, it was just kind of like, I guess, became apparent to me that there's, even in the officially set up organizations whose job is to basically try to create social change, that there's huge problems, gaps, a lot of failures. I could rant for a while about why I think the not-for-profit sector can't save us.
Sure.
And I think it was maybe our first ever episode, I talked about going to Progress, which is a big meetup of like 2,000 people from NGOs all around Australia. And I walked out feeling really quite deflated.
Yeah.
I probably don't need to get into that too much. But I guess what I'm doing is maybe making a little bit of a distinction between the stuff you were talking about before, which is kind of what I guess I would have viewed more as like your personal
ideology
politics, in terms of how you actually want to move through the world, the kind of person you want to be. And that is sort of what, definitely veganism to a certain extent is an ideology of like personal responsibility. And there's lots of things that are kind of inherently problematic about that idea.
Sure.
And that is something that the animal movement is currently wrestling with, in terms of, it's not a consumer problem. It's just this, it's a systemic problem and a moral problem.
Yeah, veganism is this sort of inherently individualized response to that systemic problem.
Yeah. And I definitely don't agree with that being the be-all and end-all of the
totally.
Situation. I understand that there are lots of really good reasons why people can't or won't stop eating animal products. And I'm not the kind of, not hardline on that issue, because I think there's a whole lot of nuance around it that is disregarded by the animal movement at large. I guess connecting those things to a broader political outlook that then starts to relate to how we need to actually change the systems that we operate under versus just like how should we treat each other individually is that's probably more what I've started to do in the last couple of years. And like, yeah, this podcast has been a great opportunity to actively develop that. And I owe a lot to the group as well, the Ozpol Chairperson Facebook group. Like, I've learned so much just reading what other people think and feel and being directed to resources and having really interesting and vibrant kind of conversations there, as well as, you know, having a bit of fun, which I think really helps all of that other stuff go down. So, yeah, I mean, finding a community online of people who are interested in the same things I am and who, you know, in many cases have been thinking about it for a lot longer has been fantastic. Like, I really, like, I do feel like I, you know, now that I'm saying it, the group is probably to a large extent responsible for, like, that acceleration of my, like, interest in politics over the last few years. So, thanks, bud.
No worries.
And thanks all you guys.
I was just thinking, I should have said this last week when we did the interview with me, but a big part of the reason I started paying attention to Ozpol was going and reading the paper and doing the crossword with our friend Lewis, and he paid attention to politics like his whole childhood, and so we would kind of like flick through the newspaper on the way to the cryptic, and he'd be like, oh, that's what's going on here, that's who this guy is, and yeah, so...
For sure, and...
But it's the same thing with the crossword and the friend, you know, it's like having the supportive community, this fun thing, and then you get the information as well, so...
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you brought that up, actually, because the other sort of really major factor was you and Lewis, who's living with the two of you, and not that you're only my only two politically engaged friends, but, you know, we were a very tight, like, group of three, and would hang out and talk a lot, and... Yeah, both of you were much more engaged than I was. And that's really where, like, you know, you are where I got most of my opinions for the first, like, few years, and probably still now out of uni. So, I mean, having friends who are interested and engaged in it was, like, makes a huge difference, obviously. And, you know, that's to a certain extent, like, I think a form of privilege as well. Like, just existing in a community where people have the kind of bandwidth to sit around and talk about politics was really vital to me. And that's something that, you know, I think everybody should ideally have access to if they want it. But yeah, it's not something that everybody can do. So like, that's something that I'm really appreciative of on a personal level to you and Lou, like I owe you a lot, but also, that, yeah, there's a kind of structural advantage that is also kind of related to as well.
So you've talked a bit about animals and veganism and so on. And I mentioned Afroism, which I guess is sort of a more overtly political angle on veganism. But yeah, maybe could you just talk a bit about why animal rights is important to you and a little bit about what you do in that field and maybe about your dog and the speech you gave recently. I don't know. Sorry, there's a lot of different things I'm laying down there, but yeah.
Could you, I can pick a few of them up, piece them together, see how we go. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess, as you pointed out before, aside from being very interested in and engaged with feminist ideas, probably animals would be the second thing that I started to really think about. It was you that introduced me to them, that, like, you were the first vegetarian person that I my mum briefly tried to make the family go vegetarian, didn't really stick. You were veggie and that was like a thing. We would talk about it. You know, we'd have these kind of like moral, or I don't know, what do you call them? Discussions about the morality around it. And then you went vegan when we were in uni, and you just kind of made it look pretty easy. And I guess, I don't know if I'd just been like worn down over time, but like, I guess I'd known for a while that I felt like it was fundamentally wrong to kill living sentient individuals in order to eat them. Like, I guess most people probably live with that cognitive dissonance to a certain extent, I would argue. And the whole system is set up to make it as easy as possible for you to ignore that.
Yeah.
You know, when the meat gets to you, it doesn't look anything like the animal that it once was. Mm. We're all protected from having to see or think about that deliberately.
Do you mind if, Sorry, I know I just asked you this question, but I want to interrupt with a story kind of answers it that might reflect poorly on you as a vegan now. But it was when we were all living together, and it was 2012. It was like Epic Meal Time was big.
Yeah,
was
ascendant, that's right.
And
yeah,
there was a lot of like candied whiskey bacon going on in the house, which as you say, I was vegan at the time, newly vegan. And I thought Lewis was the soft touch here. I was like, Zach, no way. He's like hard-headed. He knows what he wants. He's not going to...
Always eating bacon like all the time.
All the time. So yeah, I worked on Lewis and we were like drunkenly out in Brunswick Street one night and he was like, fine, I'll go vegetarian. We got a falafel to celebrate. And he spent like 2 days having this like immense moral high ground over you of like, you know, just like, no, I won't have that candied bacon, Zach, and like all this shit. And I got up one morning and you were there like at the stove in the kitchen and I was like, oh, hey, man. And you turned around and you sort of like pretty grumpily were like, I've decided to go vegan. Turned back to the baked beans. And I was like, fuck yeah. All we needed was like a sense of moral inferiority.
Oh, yeah, to get one over at Lewis. Yeah. Bada boom. And I've maintained that moral high ground to this day. Yeah. Well, let's be... I mean, I was an extremely lax vegan for the first couple of years.
Sure. Yeah.
And like, I went traveling for a year and ate whatever I wanted on that time. Mm. But yeah, I mean, things have kind of changed for me recently since I've started working at like an animal charity, and I'm just kind of confronted on a near daily basis with the reality of the production of animal products. And it's just like, it's much harder to, you know, maintain that like intellectual or emotional distance from it. So yeah, what was the kind of rest of your question? It was like talking about connecting kind of veganism to a broader like political.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, it's fundamentally an like, I think when I talk about animal agriculture and the animal industries, I'm really talking about them specifically in the context of like how they exist now under capitalism.
Sure.
If we're talking about like whether it's morally right or wrong in a kind of like philosophical void to kill an animal in order to survive, like that's kind of a different question. And I would argue relatively irrelevant to our, most of our day-to-day lives. If we're talking about people in...
Is it okay to eat this beef that I bought from Woolies this morning?
Or yeah, like, that's kind of more of the question. And of course, you know, these questions change drastically based on your like political, geographical, economic context. So I'm really talking about first world countries. I'm talking about Australia specifically. We have a really high like per capita meat consumption here. And yeah, it's basically about the way that these systems have developed in order to breed and kill animals as quickly as possible in the largest numbers possible for the most profit. And that's how we've gotten where we are. So it is kind of, I think, fundamentally connected to like economic, like political economics, or however you would like to describe it. I don't know if that's a real term, but whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But yeah, one of the things that I found really interesting recently was this book called Afroism, which you mentioned, and that's APHROISM, Afroism. It's written by two sisters from the US called AFKO, APHKO, and SILKO. And it's a collection of essays that they had written for their website, which I'm pretty sure was called Black Vegans Rock. So they're two, they're both vegan, they're black, and they write about basically the kind of connections between race and speciesism, the idea of, you know, human supremacy. And
connecting that to white supremacy.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, the term speciesism itself is like something that I'm only just becoming comfortable using because there is, you know, the animal movement has form for co-opting the language around human suffering, comparing animals, you know, in the food system to like the Holocaust or slavery or whatever, whilst at the same time doing nothing to actually materially support like
the human things that they're drawing that equivalent to.
Actively like reinforcing white supremacy and disregarding, say, the racial and economic motivations that somebody might have to need to eat animal products or whatever. But yeah, so as you say, one of the like kind of one of the fundamental ideas of this philosophy that AFCO and Silco develop in this book, which they term Black Veganism, sort of the name of their philosophy, is yeah the what they see is a very explicit connection between speciesism and white supremacy, and basically the argument goes that white supremacy can't exist without the idea of animalization.
Mm.
If you want a definition for animalization, it just means to make something not human. That's it, to animalize something. So they basically make the argument that white supremacy grades humans on a scale from human or most human at the top to least human at the bottom, and then going all the way down to actual literal animals. So white people are at the top. The further away you get from whiteness, the closer you are to being an animal, you know. And that's why I think there's a lot of, there's conflict around the animal movement, like co-opting these terms, because the animalization of people of color
becomes less important than the animalization of the animals or something like that.
Well, it's just, like, it's something that is used as a tool of racial subjugation,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So co-opting it is kind of like perverse in that sense.
Mm.
AFCO and Silco go on to basically make arguments that are sort of question how problematic it is to do that stuff, but that's territory I'm not going to get into.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's kind of maybe a little bit beyond me. But basically, what they argue is if we can undo the idea of the separation between humans and non-human animals, if we get rid of that concept of animalization... Animalization is a fundamental building block for the concept of white supremacy. So to effectively undo white supremacy, we need to erase this artificial conceptual barrier that we've erected between ourselves and all other animals. And I think that's a really compelling concept.
Yeah, absolutely.
It made a lot of sense to me. And I think it was important for me to begin to situate caring for animals in kind of a broader political philosophy, because it does, like, the movement itself is not some, you know, often at best, like, there are lots of people out there doing good work for sure, and I don't want to denigrate that, but I think the mainstream animal movement is at best, like, politically agnostic, but
sure,
at worst often upholds
actively
white supremacy,
reinforcing
and
creating,
you know, can be super classist
well. And of course, sexism in PETA, especially of all of the like domestic violence stuff, and about
a million percent. And because the movement, like politically speaking, you know, as a movement, is not super progressive. Of course, the spaces themselves are not progressive.
Yeah.
And you know, I know from kind of firsthand accounts from other people in the animal movement that many animal organizations are not safe for women. You know, let alone people who are gender non-conforming or not white or whatever. So there's like a lot of problems to approach there, and I guess being up close with it made that starkly obvious to me, and reading the writing of these of AF and Silco was kind of formative for me, I guess, in starting to understand, like, no, there is actually really good conceptual links between like anti-racism and anti-speciesism. These are things that can coexist
and should and can productively be
like necessarily according to their writing. So I mean, that was something that I found really interesting recently, and that I'm talking to everybody who will listen about. So thank you for asking me. I didn't do a very good job of describing
it. No, I think you did a great job. But look, it was a little rude that I had to shoehorn Michel Foucault into my interview without being asked. So, you know, next year we can work on that. You mentioned that you went overseas for a year, and this is maybe a little bit rude, and I, you know, want to say I love you and we've been good friends for a while before.
Yeah,
but
go on.
You were...
kind of a dick?
Kind of a dick, yeah. But beforehand, and look, I mean... I've also been a dick and am still sometimes. But when you came back, I think there was a really marked change in how you related to people. And you don't necessarily have to have an answer about like what in the trip made that change, but it seemed like it was probably a pretty significant trip for you. And yeah, do you maybe have like a little bit to say about your experiences there and if that's affected your political and personal outlook and that sort of thing?
I'm not sure that the experiences of that trip. You know, I spent a couple of months living and working in South America, and a little bit of time in Europe as well over that year. I don't think the experiences that I had there necessarily were hugely politically formative. I mean, it's obviously always eye-opening for anybody from a first world country to go and visit somewhere that is not nearly as economically affluent or, you know what I mean?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, and to live in a different way for a while, for sure, that is definitely thought-provoking. But I think probably it's more connected to what I was talking about before in the sense of, like, learning to understand my own personal interactions with other people as a, like, an implementation of my politics.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So, as you say, I was known as a dick. I was known as a mean guy who would make jokes at other people's expense.
To be clear to the listeners, like, he wasn't, like, a horrendous bully or anything, but it was like, you know, I would be like, oh, I like this movie. And he'd be like, haha, that movie sucks.
And therefore, so do you.
Yeah.
I was also one of those really cool people who builds their entire personality around what their taste in music and movies is. Just an all-around great guy. Thanks for sticking around.
No, and vice versa. Look, we really were very gentle on me last episode, so I'm sorry for going a bit hard on you.
No, it's good. I know, but actually, I think you have kind of touched on something interesting, and I'm gonna get there.
Sure.
I feel like I'm headed in the right direction. So, I was like known as a dick, and I would just like be mean to the people around me because I thought it was funny, or like because I thought that they could they knew that I was joking or whatever.
Which we mostly did.
Yeah, but occasionally it was really hurtful, and it was Lewis initially who pulled me up on it. It was basically, you know, I said something mean, which was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, and he was just like, it's not funny when you do this, it's just upsetting and hurtful, you really need to stop it. And then you told me the same thing. And, you know, I'm just so thankful for you two for taking the time, not just writing the friendship off, but actually taking the time to tell me that, no, look, I think, you know, we want you to improve, and here's what you should do. And I think probably what happened in my time away is that I had the opportunity to kind of think about that, ruminate on it, and actually try to put it into practice and start to understand that the most important way that your politics can manifest is in your personal interactions. And this became really key as well, to kind of connect that to something I was talking about earlier, my development as a feminist. There's some air quotes.
Some scare going on. Yeah.
In the sense of like my behavior in my like romantic relationships as like a cishet guy, that's a really important element of actually being a good feminist, a good, you know, if you want to call it an ally or whatever. But that like understanding how kind of the sharing of emotional burdens, how those things naturally fall in relationships and actually actively working to undo them, or simple things like household chores, like, you know, this probably sounds like some extremely basic shit to most people listening, but it's just like that. You know, if you are letting that stuff, if you're in a cishet relationship and you're letting those like things fall along typically gendered lines, and you know, the weight of those kind of domestic tasks and emotional tasks being, you know, falling to the woman naturally, like you're not being a good feminist. You can go to all the rallies and read the books and theories.
This is what a feminist looks like shirt.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and you use the hashtags and all that kind of stuff. But if you're not actually enacting that in your personal relationships, then like what fucking good is it? And that is something that I'm really indebted to my partner too, for really like helping me along in that journey and helping me understand that. And I can't thank her enough for it. And I don't know if she wants me to like shout her out by name on the podcast, so I might just like not.
Yeah.
But I love you, bub, and thank you so much for helping me out. And I guess, I mean, ultimately, that's maybe the like takeaway here, is that I owe like all of my development to the people around me who kind of took care of me and took an interest in me and were patient with me and let me kind of grow, from my parents and my siblings to you and Lou, and now to my partner, who has just taken so much love and care to like try to help me be a better person. So, and you know, and out to the kind of community, especially people on AusPol shitposting who, yeah, you know, kind of nurture each other and have nurtured me in a way that like is has just been so important. So I guess that's probably, I don't have like, I'm not a Marxist or whatever, but I really like it when people are nice to me. That's my,
yeah, that's a damn good political
that's my
philosophy.
Political philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. We are well over our half hour, and there was one last kind of topic that I wanted to touch on, which is film and music. So maybe, I think that's been a real big part of your life for a long time, maybe a bit less so recently, but could you, in like 1 minute or less, talk about why that's important for you and like what that has been like as part of your life?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like I studied film and TV at uni, so I had a relatively like apolitical experience at university, I guess, 3 years of just mostly talking about technique in film. And yeah, honestly, like it's something I think it was really lacking from that course was understanding what kind of social and political and philosophical messages these movies are actually trying to get across, and unpacking the, I guess, the ideological framework that these pieces of media are coming from, and learning to actually understand and critically consume media, I think was critical to my political development, because you start to look at everything that you're being told that the movie isn't actually explicitly saying. And that's actually, I think, you know, that's really critical when you're consuming any form of media, but like, you know, news media or listening to a politician speak or whatever. And so I think actually, yeah, that's like probably did arm me with that ability to like my love of film and my love of like analyzing, like, I'm going to sound like a wanker, but the language of cinema, I can't believe I said that, but you know what I mean? Like that has been really, I think has really informed the way that I look critically at stuff. And when it comes to music, music is just fun. It's great. I love it. It's a very important part of my life, just like personally. But I guess as a result of like becoming a little bit more politically engaged, I find it hard to listen to stuff that doesn't sort of align, or at least I try not to listen to stuff that doesn't kind of align with what I believe to a certain extent, try to deliberately seek out artists who kind of are progressive in their music and in real life. I mean, I make exceptions for that. I still listen to a lot of like rap music from the early 90s, which probably doesn't fit my
Biggie Smalls
ideas.
Extremely respectful to women.
A lot of Biggie still in high rotation. But, you know, like I learned to love Biggie with you, and we would always kind of make the point of like, haha, maybe not back when we were 17.
No,
but
sure,
definitely
but
over the last couple of years, we're like, this is a great song. Boy, this
we
is...
We can't
it.
Sing along
it's
with
so
it at all.
Misogynist.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. That's probably a quick answer to that question, I guess.
Regularly describe you to other people as a motherfucking musical genius, which is a sort of riff on RuPaul being a motherfucking marketing genius.
That's very nice.
Yeah. I mean, I think I remember, you know, us coming up together. You were a music dude for a long time, and then at some point you were like, oh, film. And like a lot of your obsessive enthusiasm kind of transferred into that, and but yeah, you are a really talented and creative person, and I'm always hassling you to like make movies and shit, which isn't happening, which is fine because it's obviously like
we're doing this instead.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, it's true. And all of the, you know, it's nice getting a little bit of the Zach magic in the stings and the theme song.
I think
you
have a lot of fun making the stings. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, but we might do movies, though. Like, I really want to start making AusPol Snack Pod video. I want to do AusPol Snack Tube. I want to move into YouTube.
Yeah.
It's so time intensive.
It's a lot of work, yeah.
Basically, I'm going to need to figure out a way to work one less day a week and then do this instead, which could happen, but, you know, stay tuned.
Which reminds me, as we are now wrapping up, I think that might be the end of the interview bit, but if you would like some more AusPol Snack Tube or AusPol related movie content, you should support our show by going to www.patreon.com/AusPolSnackPod. For just $1 a month, you get a bonus episode. And if you give us more than that, you'll get some other cool shit, including, hopefully, one day, Zach going down to less days of work and thus us doing more shit. I mean, that's a stretch goal. It's not imminent, but it would be nice. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, find us on Twitter and on Facebook, and join the group if you're not in it
get
and you
nice
want to get
supportive
nurtured.
Comrades. Yeah. Cool. All right. I think that might be us for the week.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We are going back. We're doing another kind of like unusual episode next week.
Yep.
And then after that, we'll be back to our regular like news wrap up sort of format. So yeah, I hope everybody's having if you're having a break,
yep.
I hope it's a good one.
Yep. Have a happy new year and a merry Krimbus or whatever you celebrate don't celebrate around this time of year.
All of that.
Yeah.
And make sure that you keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.